B is for Burglar by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1985 by Sue Grafton. Prologue. After it's over, of course, you want to kick yourself for all the things you didn't see at the time. The had I but known school of private investigation, perhaps. My name is Kinsey Milhone, and most of my reports begin the same way. I start by asserting who I am and what I do, as though by stating the same few basic facts, I can make sense out of everything that comes afterward. This is what's true of me in brief. I'm female, age 32, single, self-employed. I went through the police academy when I was 20, joining Santa Teresa Police Department on graduation. I don't even remember now how I pictured the job before I took it on. I must have had vague, idealistic notions of law and order, the good guys versus the bad, with occasional court appearances in which I'd be asked to testify as to which was which. In my view, the bad guys would all go to jail, thus making it safe for the rest of us to carry on. After a while, I realized how naive I was. I was frustrated at the restrictions, and frustrated because back then, police women were viewed with a mixture of curiosity and scorn. I didn't want to spend my days defending myself against good-natured insults, or having to prove how tough I was again and again. I wasn't getting paid enough to deal with all that grief, so I got out. For 2 years I tried an assortment of occupations, but none had the same pull. Whatever else is true of police work, it does entail the intermittent sick thrill of life on the edge. I was hooked on the adrenal rush, and I couldn't go back to the commonplace. Eventually, I joined a small firm of private investigators and spent another 2 years learning the business, after which I opened an office of my own, duly licensed and bonded. I've been at it for 5 years, supporting myself in a modest way. I'm wiser now than I used to be, and I'm more experienced, but the fact remains that when a client sits down in the chair across the desk from me, I never know what's going to happen next. Chapter 1. I'd been in the office no more than 20 minutes that morning. I'd opened the French doors out onto the second floor balcony to let in some fresh air, and I'd put on the coffee pot. It was June in Santa Teresa, which means chill morning fog and hazy afternoons. It wasn't 9 o'clock yet. I was just sorting through the mail from the day before when I heard a tap at the door and a woman breezed in. "Oh, good, you're here," she said. "You must be Kinsey Milhone. I'm Beverly Danziger." We shook hands, and she promptly sat down and started rooting through her bag. She found a pack of filter-tipped cigarettes and shook one out. "I hope you don't mind if I smoke," she said, lighting up without waiting for a response. She inhaled and then extinguished the match with a mouthful of smoke, idly searching about for an ashtray. I took one from the top of my file cabinet, dusted it off, and passed it over to her, offering her coffee at the same time. "Oh, sure, why not?" she said with a laugh. "I'm already hyper this morning, so I might as well. I just drove up from Los Angeles right through the rush hour traffic. God!" I poured her a mug of coffee, doing a quick visual survey. She was in her late 30s, by my guess, petite, energetic, well-groomed. Her hair was a glossy black and quite straight. The cut was angular and perfectly layered so that it framed her small face like a bathing cap. She had bright blue eyes, black lashes, a clear complexion with just a hint of blusher high on each cheekbone. She wore a boat-necked sweater and a pale blue cotton knit and a pale blue poplin skirt. The bag she carried was of quality leather, soft and supple, with a number of zippered compartments containing God knows what. Her nails were long and tapered, painted a rosy pink, and she wore a wedding ring studded with rubies. She projected self-confidence and a certain careless attention to style, conservatively packaged like the complimentary gift wrap in a classy department store. She shook her head to the offer of cream and sugar, so I added half and half to my own mug and got down to business. "What can I help you with?" "I'm hoping you can locate my sister for me," she said. She was searching through her handbag again. She took out her address book, a rosewood pen and pencil set, and a long white envelope, which she placed on the edge of my desk. I'd never seen anyone so self-absorbed, but it wasn't unattractive stuff. She gave me a quick smile then, as though she knew that. She opened the address book and turned it so that it faced me, pointing to one of the entries with a rosy fingertip. "You'll want to make a note of the address and telephone number," she said. "Her name is Elaine Bolt. She has a condo in Via Madrina, and that second one is her address in Florida. She spends several months a year down in Boca." I was feeling somewhat puzzled, but I noted the addresses while she took a legal-looking document out of the long white envelope. She studied it briefly, as though the contents might have changed since she'd last seen it. "How long has she been missing?" I asked. Beverly Danziger gave me an uncomfortable look. "Well, I don't know if she's missing exactly. I just don't know where she is, and I've got to get these papers signed. I know it sounds dumb. She's only entitled to a ninth interest, and it probably won't come to more than $2,000 or $3,000, but the money can't be distributed until we have her notarized signature. Here, you can see for yourself." I took the document and read through the contents. It had been drawn up by a firm of attorneys in Columbus, Ohio, and it was full of whereases, adjudgeds, ordereds, and whatnots, which added up to the fact that a man named Sidney Rowan had died, and the various people listed were entitled to portions of his estate. Beverly Danziger was the third party listed, with a Los Angeles address, and Elaine Bolt was fourth, with an address here in Santa Teresa. "Sidney Rowan was some kind of cousin," she went on garrulously. "I don't believe I ever met the man, but I got this notice, and I assume Elaine got one, too. I signed the form and got it notarized and sent off, and then didn't think any more about it. You can see from the cover letter that this all took place 6 months ago. Then, lo and behold, I got a call last week from the attorney. What's his name again?" I glanced at the document. "Wender," I said. "Oh, that's right. I don't know why I keep blocking that. Anyway, Mr. Wender's office called to say they'd never heard from Elaine. Naturally, I assumed she'd gone off to Florida as usual and just hadn't bothered to have her mail sent, so I got in touch with the manager of her condominium here. She hasn't heard from Elaine in months. Well, she did at first, but not recently."
"Have you tried calling the Florida number?"
"From what I understand, the attorney tried several times. Apparently she had a friend staying with her, and Mr. Wender left his name and number, but Elaine never called back. Tilly had about the same luck."
"Tilly?"
"The woman who manages the building here where Elaine has her permanent residence. Tilly's been forwarding the mail, and she says Elaine usually drops her a little note every other week or so, but she hasn't heard anything since March. Frankly, it's a nuisance more than anything else, but I don't have time to track her down myself." Beverly took a final drag of the cigarette and stubbed it out with a series of pecking motions. I was still taking notes, but I suppose the skepticism was showing in my face. "What's the matter? Isn't this the sort of work you do?"
"Sure, but I charge $30 an hour plus expenses. If there's only $2,000 or $3,000 involved, I wonder if it's going to be worth it to you."
"Oh, I fully intend to have the estate reimburse me out of Elaine's share, since she caused all this trouble to begin with. I mean, everything's come to a screeching halt until her signature can be obtained. I must say, it's typical of the way she's behaved all her life."
"Suppose I end up flying down to Florida to look for her. Even if I only charge you half my usually hourly rate for travel time, it'll cost a fortune. Look, Mrs. Danziger..."
"Beverly, please."
"All right, Beverly. I don't want to discourage your business, but in all honesty, it sounds like something you could handle yourself. I'd even be happy to suggest some ways to go about it."
Beverly gave me a smile then, but it had a hard edge to it, and I realized at long last that she was used to getting her way. Her eyes had widened to a china glaze, as blue and unyielding as glass. The black lashes blinked mechanically. "Elaine and I are not on the best of terms," she said smoothly. "I feel I've already devoted quite enough time to this, but I promised Mr. Wender I'd find her so the estate can be settled. He's under pressure from the other heirs, and he's putting pressure on me. I can give you an advance if you like." She was back in her bag again, coming up with a checkbook this time.
She uncapped the rosewood pen and stared at me. Will $750 suffice? I reached into my bottom drawer. I'll draw up a contract. I walked the check over to the bank, and then I retrieved my car from the lot behind the office and drove over to Elaine Bolt's address on Via Madrina. It wasn't far from the downtown area. I figured this was a routine matter I could settle in a day or two, and I was thinking with regret that I'd probably end up refunding half the money I'd just deposited. Not that I was doing much else anyway. Things were slow. The neighborhood Elaine Bolt lived in was composed of modest 1930s bungalows, mixed with occasional apartment complexes. So far, the little frame and stucco cottages were predominant, but the properties were being converted to commercial use one by one. Chiropractors were moving in, and cut-rate dentists who were willing to give you twilight sleep so you could have your teeth cleaned without cringing. One-day dentures, credit. It was worrisome. What did they do to you if you missed a payment on your upper plate? The area was still largely intact, old-age pensioners stubbornly propping up their hydrangea bushes. But real estate syndicates would eventually mow them all down. There's a lot of money in Santa Teresa, and much of it is devoted to maintaining a certain look to the town. There are no flashing neon signs, no slums, no fume-spewing manufacturing complexes to blight the landscape. Everything is stucco, red tile roofs, bougainvillea, distressed beams, adobe brick walls, arched windows, palm trees, balconies, ferns, fountains, paseos, and flowers in bloom. Historical restorations abound. It's all oddly unsettling. So lush and refined that it ruins you for any place else. When I reached Mrs. Bolt's address, I parked my car out front and locked it, taking a few minutes then to survey the premises. The condominium was a curiosity. The building itself was shaped like a horseshoe with broad arms opening onto the street. Three stories high, parking level underneath, a strange combination of modern and mock Spanish. There were arches and balconies along the front, with tall wrought-iron gates sweeping inward to a palm-planted courtyard, but the sides and back of the building were flat and unadorned, as though the architect had applied a Mediterranean veneer to a plain plywood box, adding a lip of red tile at the top to suggest an entire roof when there was none. Even the palms looked like cardboard cutouts, propped up with sticks. I passed through the courtyard and found myself in a glass-enclosed lobby with a row of mailboxes and door buzzers on the right. On my left, through another set of glass doors, apparently kept locked, I could see a set of elevator doors and an exit leading to a set of fire stairs. Huge potted plants had been artfully arranged throughout the entranceway. Straight ahead, a door led out onto a patio where I caught sight of a pool surrounded by bright yellow canvas deck chairs. I checked the tenants' names, which were punched out on strips of plastic tape and pasted alongside each apartment buzzer. There were 24 units. The manager, Tilly Alberg, occupied apartment 1. An E. Bolt was listed at apartment 9, which I guessed was on the second floor. I gave E. Bolt a buzz first. For all I knew, she'd answer on the intercom and then my job would be done. Stranger things had happened, and I didn't want to make a fool of myself looking high and low for a lady who might well by now be at home. There was no response, so I tried Tilly Alberg. After 10 seconds, her voice crackled into the intercom as though the sound were being transmitted from outer space.
Yes?
I placed my mouth near the box, raising my voice slightly. Mrs. Alberg, my name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private detective here in town. Elaine Bolt's sister asked me to see if I could locate her, and I wondered if I might talk to you. There was a moment of white noise, and then a reluctant reply.
Well, I suppose. I was on my way out, but I guess 10 minutes won't hurt. I'm on the ground floor. Come through the door to the right of the elevator, and it's down at the end of the hall to the left.
The buzzer sounded, and I pushed through the glass doors. Tilly Ahlberg had left her front door ajar while she collected a lightweight jacket, her purse, and a collapsible shopping cart that rested against the hall table. I tapped on the door frame, and she appeared from my left. I caught a glimpse of a refrigerator and a portion of kitchen counter. Tilly Ahlberg was probably in her 60s, with apricot-tinted hair and a permanent wave that looked as if it had just been done. The curl must have been a little frizzier than she liked, because she was pulling on a crocheted cotton cap. An unruly fringe of apricot hair was still peeking out, like Ronald McDonald's, and she was in the process of tucking it away. Her eyes were hazel, and there was a powdery patina of pale ginger freckles on her face. She wore a shapeless skirt, hose, and running shoes, and she looked like she was capable of covering ground when she wanted to. "I hope I didn't seem unsociable," she said comfortably, "but if I don't get to the market first thing in the morning, I lose heart." "It shouldn't take long anyway," I said. "Can you tell me when you last heard from Mrs. Bolt? Is she Miss or Mrs?"
"Mrs. She's a widow, though she's only 43 years old. She was married to a man who had a string of manufacturing plants down south. As I understand it, he dropped dead of a heart attack 3 years ago and left her a bundle. That's when she bought this place. Here, have a seat if you like."
Tilly moved off to the right, leading the way into a living room furnished with antique reproductions. A gauzy golden light came through the pale yellow shears, and I could still smell the remnants of breakfast. Bacon and coffee, and something laced with cinnamon. Having established that she was in a hurry, she seemed ready to give me as much time as I wanted. She sat down on an ottoman, and I took a wooden rocking chair. "I understand she's usually in Florida this time of year," I said.
"Well, yes, she's got another condominium down there, in Boca Raton, wherever that is. Near Fort Lauderdale, I guess. I've never been to Florida myself, so these towns are all just names to me. Anyhow, she usually goes down around the 1st of February and comes back to California late July or early August. She likes the heat, she says."
"And you forward mail to her while she's gone?"
Tilly nodded. "I do that about once a week in batches, depending on how much is accumulated. Then she sends me back a note every couple of weeks. A postcard, you know, just to say hi and how the weather is and if she needs someone let in to clean the drapes or something of that nature. This year she wrote me through the 1st of March, and since then I haven't heard a word. Now that's not like her a bit."
"Do you still have the postcards by any chance?"
"No, I just threw them out like I always do. I'm not much for collecting things like that. There's too much paper piling up in the world, if you ask me.
I read 'em and tossed 'em and never thought a thing of it." "She didn't mention taking a side trip or anything like that?"
"Not a word. Of course, it's none of my business in the first place."
"Did she seem distressed?"
Tilly smiled ruefully.
"Well, it's hard to seem upset on the message side of a postcard, you know. There isn't but that much room. She sounded fine to me." "Do you have any guesses about where she might be?"
"Not a one. All I know is it's not like her not to write. I tried calling 4 or 5 times. Once some woman friend of hers answered, but she was real abrupt, and after that there wasn't anything at all."
"Who was the friend? Anyone you knew?"
"No, but now I don't know who she knows in Boca. It could have been anyone. I didn't make a note of the name, and wouldn't know it if you said it to me right this minute."
"What about the mail she's been getting? Are her bills still coming in?"
She shrugged at that. "It looks that way to me. I haven't paid much attention. I've just shipped on whatever came in. I do have a few I was about to forward, if you'd like to see them."
She got up and crossed to an oak secretary, opening one of the glass doors by turning the key in the lock. She took out a short stack of envelopes and sorted through them, then handed them to me.
"This is the kind of thing she usually gets."
I did the same quick sorting job. Visa, MasterCard, Saks Fifth Avenue. A furrier named Jacques with an address in Boca Raton. A bill from a John Pickett DDS Incorporated right around the corner on Arbol. No personal letters at all. Does she pay utility bills from here, too? I asked.
I already sent those this month.
Could she have been arrested?
That sparked a laugh.
Oh, no, not her. She wasn't anything like that. She didn't drive a car, you know, but she wasn't the type to get so much as a jaywalking ticket.
Accident? Illness? Drink? Drugs? I felt like a doctor interviewing a patient for an annual physical.
Tilly's expression was skeptical. She could be in the hospital, I suppose, but surely she would have let us know. I find it very peculiar, to tell you the truth. If that sister of hers hadn't come along, I might have gotten in touch with the police myself. There's just something not right.
But there are lots of explanations for where she might be, I said. She's an adult. Apparently she's got money and no pressing business. She really doesn't have to notify anybody of her whereabouts if she doesn't want to. She might be on a cruise. Or maybe she's taken a lover and absconded with him. Maybe she and this girlfriend of hers took off on a toot. It might never occur to her that anyone was trying to get in touch.
That's why I haven't really done anything so far. But it doesn't sit well with me. I don't think she'd leave without a word to anyone.
Well, let me look into it. I don't want to hold you up right now, but I'll want to see her apartment at some point, I said. I got up and Tilly rose automatically. I shook her hand and thanked her for her help. Hang on to the mail for the time being, if you would, I said. I'm going to chase down some other possibilities, but I'll get back to you in a day or two and let you know what I've come up with. I don't think there's any reason to worry.
I hope not, Tilly said. She's a wonderful person.
I gave Tilly my card before we parted company. I wasn't worried yet myself, but my curiosity had been aroused, and I was eager to get on with it. Chapter 2. On the way back to the office, I stopped off at the public library. I went to the reference department and pulled the city directory for Boca Raton, checking the address I had for Elaine Bolt against the addresses listed. Sure enough, she was there with a telephone number that matched the one I'd been given. I noted the names of several other owners of adjacent condominiums, jotting down telephone numbers. There seemed to be a number of buildings in the same complex, and I guessed that it was an entire planned community. There was a general sales office, a telephone number for tennis courts, a health spa, and a recreational facility. I made notes of everything just to save myself a possible trip back. When I reached the office, I opened a file on Elaine Bolt, logging the time I'd put in so far and the information I had. I tried the Florida number, letting it ring maybe 30 times without luck. And then I put in a call to the sales office of the Boca Raton condominium. They gave me the name of the resident manager in Elaine Bolt's building, a Roland Makowski, apartment 101, who picked up on the first ring. Makowski here. I told him as briefly as possible who I was and why I was trying to get in touch with Elaine Bolt. She didn't come down this year, he said. She's usually here about this time, but I guess she had a change of plans.
Are you sure?
Well, I haven't seen her. I've been up and down and around this building day in and day out, and I never laid eyes on her. That's all I know. I guess she could be here if she's always someplace where I'm not, he said. That friend of hers, Pat, is here, but Mrs. Bolt went off someplace else, is what I was told. Maybe she could tell you where. I just bumped into her hanging towels out on the rail, which we don't allow. The balcony's not a drying rack, and I told her as much. She kind of went off in a huff.
Can you tell me her last name?
What?
Can you tell me Pat's last name? Mrs. Bolt's friend.
Oh, yes. I waited a moment. I've got a pencil and paper, I said. Oh, it's Usher. Like in a movie theater? She sublet, she said. What's your name again? I gave him my name again and my office number in case he wanted to get in touch. It was not a satisfactory conversation. Pat Usher seemed to be the only link to Elaine Bolt's whereabouts, and I thought it essential to talk to her as soon as possible. I put in another call to Elaine's Florida number, letting it ring until I got annoyed with the sound. Nothing. If Pat Usher was still in the apartment, she was resolutely refusing to answer the phone. I checked the list I'd made of neighboring apartments and tried the telephone number of a Robert Peretti, who apparently lived right next door. No answer. I tried the number for the neighbor on the other side, dutifully letting the phone ring 10 times, as the telephone company advises us. At long last, someone answered. A very old someone by the sound of her.
Yes?
She sounded as if she were feeble and might want to weep. I found myself speaking loudly and carefully, as though to the hearing impaired. Mrs. Oxner?
Yes?
My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm calling from California, and I'm trying to reach the woman who's staying next door to you, in apartment 315. Do you happen to know if she's in? I've just called, and I let the phone ring about 30 times with no luck.
Do you have a hearing problem? She asked me. You're speaking very loudly, you know.
I laughed, bringing my tone down in a normal range. I'm sorry, I said. I wasn't sure how well you could hear me.
Oh, I can hear perfectly. I'm 88 years old, and I can't walk a step without help, but there's nothing wrong with my ears. I counted every one of those 30 rings through the wall, and I thought I'd go crazy if it went on much longer.
Has Pat Usher stepped out? I was just on the line to the building manager, and he said she was there.
Oh, she's there all right. I know she is because she slammed the door not moments ago. What was it you wanted, if that's not too impertinent of me to ask?
Well, actually, I'm trying to locate Elaine Bolt, but I understand she didn't make it down this year.
That's true, and I was awfully disappointed. She's part of a bridge foursome when Mrs. Wink and Ida Rittenhouse are here, and we count on her. We haven't been able to play a hand since last Christmas, and it's made Ida very cranky, if you want to know the truth.
Do you have any idea where Mrs. Bolt might be?
No, I don't, and I suspect the woman in there is on her way out. The condominium bylaws don't permit sublets, and I was surprised that Elaine agreed to it. We've complained aplenty to the association, and I believe Mr. Makowski has asked her to vacate. The woman has her backup, of course, claiming her agreement with Elaine covers through the end of June. If you want to have a conversation with her yourself, you'd do well to get down here soon. I saw her bringing up some cartons from the liquor store, and I believe... Well, I should say I hope she's packing up even as we speak.
Thanks, I may do that. You've been a big help. If I get down there, I'll stop by.
I don't suppose you play bridge, do you, dear? We've been reduced to playing hearts now for the last 6 months, and Ida's developing quite a mean mouth. Mrs. Wink and I can't take too much more of this.
Well, I've never played, but maybe I could give it a try, I said.
A penny a point,
she said brusquely, and I laughed. I put in a call to Tilly. She sounded out of breath, as though she'd had to run for the phone. Hi, Tilly, I said. It's me again, Kinsey.
I just got back from the market, she panted. Hang on until I catch my breath. Phew! What can I do for you?
I think I better go ahead and take a look at Elaine's apartment.
Why? What's going on?
Well, the people in Florida say she's not there, so I'm hoping we can figure out where else she might have gone. If I come back over there, could you let me in?
I guess so. I'm not doing anything except unloading groceries, and that won't take but 2 shakes.
When I reached the condominium again, I called her on the intercom, and she buzzed me through, and then met me at the elevator door with a key to Elaine's apartment. I told her the details of my conversation with Elaine's building manager down in Florida, filling her in as we rode up to the second floor.
You mean nobody down there has seen her at all? Well, something's wrong then, she said. Definitely. I know she left, and I know she fully intended to go down to Florida. I was looking out the window when the cab pulled up out front and gave a toot, and she got in. She had on her good fur coat and that fur turban that matched. She was traveling at night, which she didn't like to do. But then she wasn't feeling good, and she thought the change in climate might help.
She was sick?
Oh, you know, her sinuses were acting up, and she'd had that awful head cold or allergy or whatever it was. I don't mean to criticize, but she was a bit of a hypochondriac. She called me and said she'd decided to go ahead and fly on down almost on the spur of the moment. She wasn't really scheduled to go for nearly 2 weeks, but then the doctor said it might do her good, and I guess she booked the first flight she could get.
Do you know if she used a travel agent?
I'm almost sure she did. Probably one close by. Since she didn't drive, she liked to deal with businesses within walking distance where she could. Here it is.
Tilly had paused outside of apartment 9, which was on the second floor, directly above hers. She unlocked the door and then followed me in. The apartment was dim, drapes drawn, the air dry and still. Tilly crossed the living room and opened the drapes.
"Nobody's been in since she left?" I asked. "Cleaning lady? Tradesman?"
"Not as far as I know."
Both of us seemed to be using our public library tones. But there's something unsettling about being in someone else's place when you're not supposed to be. I could feel a low-level electrical current surging through my gut. We did a quick tour together, and Tilly said it looked all right to her. Nothing unusual, nothing out of place. She left then, and I went through on my own, taking my time so I could do it right. This was a corner apartment, second floor front, with windows running along two sides. I took a minute to stare down at the street. There were no cars passing. A boy with a mohawk haircut was leaning up against a parked car directly below. The sides of his head were shaved to a pre-execution gray, and the strip of hair that remained stood up like dry brush in the center divider of a highway. It was dyed a shade of pink that I hadn't seen since hot pants went out of style. He looked to be 16 or 17, wearing a pair of bright red parachute pants, tucked down into combat boots, and an orange tank top with a slogan on the front that I couldn't read from where I stood. I watched him roll and light a joint. I moved to the side windows, which looked down at an angle through the ground floor windows of the small frame house next door. The roof had been gnawed by fire, the eaves of the house showing through like the frail bones of an overcooked fish. The door was boarded up, the glass broken out of the windows, apparently by the heat. A for sale sign was jammed into the dead grass like a flimsy headstone. Not much of a view for a condominium that I estimated must have cost Elaine more than $100,000. I shrugged to myself and went into the kitchen. The counters and appliances gleamed. The floor had apparently been washed and waxed. The cupboards were neatly stacked with canned goods, including some 9 Lives beef and liver platter. The refrigerator was empty, except for the usual door full of olives and pickles and mustards and jams. The electric stove had been unplugged, the cord dangling across the clock face, which read 8:20. An empty brown paper sack had been inserted in the plastic wastebasket under the sink, a cuff neatly turned down at the top. It looked as if Elaine Bolt had systematically prepared the apartment for a long absence. I left the kitchen and wandered out into the entrance hall. The layout seemed to be a duplicate of Tilly's apartment downstairs. I moved down a short corridor, glancing to my right into a small bathroom with a sink shaped like a sunken marble shell, gold-plated fixtures, gold-flecked mirrored tiles on one wall. The small wicker wastebasket under the sink was empty, except for a delicate gray-brown clump of hair clinging to the side, like the light matting when a hairbrush has been cleaned. Across from the bathroom was a small den, with a desk, a television set, an easy chair, and a sofa bed. The desk drawers contained the usual assortment of pens, paper clips, note cards, and files, which for the moment I saw no reason to examine more closely. I did come across her Social Security card, and I made a note of the number. I left the den and moved into a master suite with an adjoining bathroom. The bedroom was gloomy, with the drapes pulled, but again everything seemed in order. To the right there was a walk-in closet, large enough to rent out. Some of the hangers were empty, and I could see gaps in the articles lined up on the shelves where she'd probably packed an item. A small suitcase was still tucked down in one corner, one of the expensive designer types, covered with somebody else's name, all done in curlicues.
I checked dresser drawers randomly. Some still contained wool sweaters and plastic cleaners bags. A few were empty, except for a sachet or two left behind, like tiny scented pillows. Lingerie. A few pieces of costume jewelry. The master bath was spacious and orderly, the medicine cabinet stripped of all but a few over-the-counter remedies. I moved back to the door and stood there for a moment surveying the bedroom. There was nothing to suggest foul play or haste, burglary, vandalism, illness, suicide, drunkenness, drug abuse, confusion, or recent occupancy. Even the faint powdering of household dust on the glossy surfaces seemed undisturbed. I left, locking the door behind me. I took the elevator down to Tilly's and asked her if she had any photographs of Elaine.
"Not that I know," she said, "but I can describe her if you like. She's just about my size, which would make her 5'5", 130 pounds. She has streaked blonde hair which she wears pulled back. Blue eyes."
Tilly stopped.
"Oh, wait! Maybe I do have a picture. I just remembered one. Hold on."
She disappeared in the direction of the den, and after a few moments returned with a Polaroid snapshot that she handed to me. The picture had an orange cast to it and seemed sticky to the touch. Two women stood in the courtyard, a full-length shot, taken from perhaps 20 feet back. One, I guessed immediately, was Elaine, smiling happily, trim and elegant in a pair of well-cut slacks. The other woman was thick through the middle, with blue plastic eyeglass frames, and a hairdo that looked as if it could be removed intact. She appeared to be in her 40s, squinting into the sun self-consciously.
"This was taken last fall," Tilly said. "That's Elaine on the left."
"Who's the other woman?"
"Marty Grice, a neighbor of ours." "Now that was an awful thing. She was killed, oh gosh, I guess 6 months back. It doesn't seem that long ago."
"What happened to her?"
"Well, they think she interrupted a burglar breaking into the house. I guess he killed her on the spot and then tried to burn the place down to cover it up. It was horrible. You might have read about it in the paper."
I shook my head. There are long periods when I don't read the paper at all. But I remembered the house next door with its charred roof and windows broken out. "That's too bad," I said. "Do you mind if I keep this?"
"Go right ahead."
I glanced at it again. The image was faintly disturbing, capturing a moment not that long ago when both women grinned with such ease, unaware that anything unpleasant lay ahead. Now one was dead and the other missing. I didn't like that combination at all. "Were Elaine and this woman good friends?" I asked.
"Not really. They played bridge together now and then, but they didn't socialize aside from that. Elaine is a bit standoffish where most people are concerned. Actually, Marty used to get a little snippy about Elaine's attitude. Not that she ever said anything much about it to me, but I can remember her being a bit snide once in a while. Elaine does treat herself well, there's no doubt about that, and she tends to be insensitive to the idea that people really can't afford to live as well as she does. That fur coat of hers is a case in point. She knew Leonard and Marty were in financial straits, but she'd wear the coat over there to play bridge. To Marty, that was just like waving a red flag in front of a bull."
"That's the same coat she was wearing when you saw her last?"
"Yes, indeed. A $12,000 lynx fur coat with a matching hat."
"Wow," I said.
"Oh, it's beautiful. I'd give my eye teeth to have a coat like that."
"Can you remember anything else about her departure that night?"
"I can't say that I do. She was carrying some sort of luggage, I guess a carry-on, and the cab driver brought down the rest."
"Do you remember what cab company?"
"I really didn't pay much attention at the time, but she usually called City Cab. Or Greenstripe. Sometimes Tip-Top, though she didn't like them much. I wish I could be more help. I mean, if she left here on her way to Florida and never got there, where did she end up?"
"That's what I want to know," I said. I gave Tilly what I hoped was a reassuring smile, but I was feeling uneasy. I went back to the office and did a quick calculation of the expenses I'd run up so far. Maybe $75 for the time spent with Tilly and the time going through Elaine's apartment, Plus the time in the library and on the telephone and the long-distance charges. I've known PIs who conduct entire investigations on the phone, but I don't think it's smart. Unless you're dealing with people face-to-face, there are too many ways to be deceived and too many things to miss. I called a travel agent and got myself booked round-trip to Miami. The fare was $99 each way if I flew in the dead of night and didn't eat, drink, or go to the John. I also reserved a cheap rental car on the far end. My plane didn't leave for hours yet, so I went home and got in a 3-mile jog, then stuck a toothbrush and toothpaste in my purse and called it packing. At some point, I was going to have to track down Elaine's travel agent and find out what airline she had taken, and whether perhaps she'd booked herself through to Mexico or the Caribbean. In the meantime, I hoped I could catch Elaine's friend in Florida before she flew the coop, taking with her my only link to Elaine's whereabouts. Chapter 3. It was still dark when the plane touched down in Miami at 4:45 a.m. The airport was sparsely populated at that hour, the lighting as subdued as a funeral home's. In the baggage claim area, stacks of abandoned suitcases were piled together in shadowy glass-fronted cabinets. All the airport shops were closed. Travelers slept here and there on the unyielding plastic seats, resting their heads on bulging canvas totes, their jackets hunched up over their shoulders. The intercom paged a passenger to the white courtesy telephone, but the name was garbled and I didn't think anyone would respond. I had only managed to sleep for about an hour on the plane, and I felt rumpled and out of sorts. I picked up my rental car and a sheet map, and by 5:15 was headed north on U.S. 1. 20 miles to Fort Lauderdale, another 15 to Boca Raton. Dawn was turning the sky a pearly translucent gray, and clouds were piled up like heads of cauliflower in a roadside stand. The land on either side of the highway was flat, with white sand creeping up to the edges of the road. Patches of sawgrass and stunted cypress cut into the horizon, and Spanish moss hung from the trees like tattered rags. The air was already moist and balmy, and the streaks of orange from the rising sun hinted at a hot day to come. To kill some time, I stopped at a fast food place and ate some brown and yellow things that I washed down with a carton of orange juice. All of it tasted like something the astronauts would have had to reconstitute. By the time I reached the community where Elaine Bolt had her Florida condominium, it was nearly 7 o'clock, and the sprinkler system was sending out jets of water across the closely clipped grass. There were 6 or 7 buildings of poured concrete, each 3 stories high, with screened-in porches punctuating the low, clean lines. Hibiscus bushes added touches of bright red and pink. I circled through the area, driving slowly along the wide avenues that curved back as far as the tennis courts. Each building seemed to have its own swimming pool, cradled close, and there were already people stretched out on plastic chaise longues, sunning themselves. I spotted the street number I was looking for and pulled into a small parking lot out in front. The manager's apartment was on the ground floor, the front door standing open, the screen door secured against the onslaught of big Florida bugs that were already making warning sounds in the grass. I knocked against the aluminum frame.
"I'm right here."
It was a woman's voice, disconcertingly close. I cupped one hand, shading my eyes so that I could see who I was talking to through the screen door. "Is Mr. Makowski here?" The woman seemed to materialize on the other side, her face level with my knees.
"Hold on. I've been doing my sit-ups, and I can't get to my feet yet."
"Lord, that hurts." She hauled herself into a kneeling position, clinging to the arm of a chair.
"Makowski's off fixing the toilet in 208. What can I do for you?"
"I'm trying to get in touch with Elaine Bolt. Do you have any idea where she might be?"
"You that investigator who called from California?"
"Yes, that's me. I thought I should talk to someone down here and see if I could get a lead on her. Did she leave a forwarding address?"
"Nope. I wish I could help you out, but I don't know much more than you do. Here, come on in."
She lurched to her feet and held the screen door open.
"I'm Charmaine Makowski,
Or what's left of her.
Do you exercise?
Well, I jog, but that's about it, I said.
Good for you. Don't ever do sit-ups. That's my advice. I do 100 a day, and it always hurts.
She was still winded, her cheeks tinted pink from the effort. She was in her late 40s, wearing a bright yellow sweatsuit, her belly protruding in pregnancy. She looked like a ripe Florida grapefruit.
You got it, she said. Another one of life's little jokes. I thought it was a tumor till it started to kick. Know what that is?
She was pointing to a bump just below her waist.
That's what a belly button looks like turned inside out. It's embarrassing. Mikowski and I didn't think we could have any kids. I'm almost 50, and he's 65.
Oh, hell, what difference does it make? It's more fun than menopause, I guess.
Have you talked to that woman up in 315? Her name is Pat Usher, but you probably know that. She claims Elaine let her sublet, but I doubt that.
What's the story on that? Mrs. Bolt never talked to you about the arrangement?
Nope, not a word. All I know is this Usher woman showed up a few months ago and moved in. At first, nobody objected because we all just figured it was a 2-week visit or something like that. People in the building can have any kind of company they want for short periods of time, but the rules say you can't sublet. Prospective buyers are screened real carefully, and if we allowed sublets, it would just be an invitation for any Tom, Dick, or Harry to move in here. The whole community would start to deteriorate. Anyway, after a month, Mikowski went up to have a little chat with her, and she claims she paid Elaine for 6 months and doesn't intend to move. It's driving Mikowski around the bend.
Does she have a signed lease?
She has a receipt showing she's paid Elaine some money, but it doesn't say for what. Mikowski's had her served with an eviction notice, but she's taking her sweet time getting out.
You haven't met her yet, I take it. I'm just on my way up. Do you know if she's in?
Probably. She doesn't go out much except to the pool to work on her tan. Tell her drop dead from the management.
315 was located on the third floor in the crook of the L-shaped building. Even before I rang the bell, I had the feeling that I was being inspected through the fisheye spy hole in the middle of the door. After a moment, the door opened to the width of the burglar chain, but no face appeared.
Pat Usher?
Yes. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm an investigator from California. I'm trying to locate Elaine Bolt.
What for?
Her tone was flat, guarded, no lilt at all, and no graciousness.
Her sister's been trying to get in touch with her to sign a legal document. Can you tell me where she is?
There was a cautious silence.
Are you here to serve me papers?
No. I took out the photostatic copy of my license and passed it through the crack. The license disappeared smoothly, like a bank card being sucked into an instant cash machine. After an interval, it came back.
Just a minute. I'll see if I can find her address.
She left the door ajar, still secured by the chain. I felt a little flash of hope. Maybe I was making progress. If I could track Elaine down in another day or two, I'd feel pretty smug, which sometimes counts as much as money, whatever business you're in. I waited, staring down at the welcome mat. The letter B was defined in dark bristles, surrounded by bristles in a lighter shade. Did they have enough mud in Florida to justify a mat like that? It was coarse enough to rip the bottom of your shoe off. I glanced to my left. Just off the balcony, I could see palm trees with little beaded skirts near the top. Pat Usher was back, still talking through the crack.
I must have thrown it out. She was in Sarasota last I heard.
Already I was tired of talking to the door, and I felt a surge of irritation.
Do you mind if I come in? It's about the settlement on somebody's estate. She could pick up $2,000 or $3,000 if I can just get her signature.
Appeal to greed, I thought. Appeal to the secret yearning for a windfall. Sometimes I use it as a ploy when I am tracking down a deadbeat who's run out on a bill. This time it was even true, so my voice had this wonderful, sincere ring to it.
Did the manager send you up here?
Come on,
Would you quit being paranoid? I'm looking for Elaine, and I want to talk to you. You're the only person so far who seems to have any idea where she is.
Silence. She was pondering this as though it were an IQ test, and she could pad the results. I had to struggle with the urge to bite. This was the only lead I had, and I didn't want to blow it.
All right, she said reluctantly. Let me get some clothes on first.
When she finally opened the door, she was wearing a float, one of those gauzy print caftans you slip over your head when you're too lazy to put on your underpants. She had adhesive tape across her nose. Her eyes were puffy and circled with bruises that were fading from blue to green. She had a strip of clear tape under each eye, and her tan had dimmed to a sallow hue that made her look like she had a mild case of hepatitis.
I was in a car accident and broke my nose, she said. I don't like for people to see me like this.
She moved away from the door, the caftan sailing out behind her as though there were a breeze. I followed her in, closing the door behind me. The place was done in rattan and pastels and smelled faintly of mildew. Sliding glass doors on one side of the living room opened out onto the screened-in porch, beyond which there were only lush green treetops visible and clouds piling up like a bubble bath. She took a cigarette out of a lead crystal box on the coffee table and lit it with a matching table lighter that actually worked. She sat down on the couch, propping her bare feet up on the edge of the table. Her soles were gray.
Sit down if you want.
Her eyes were an eerie electric green, tinted by contact lenses, I had to guess. Her hair was a tawny shade, with a luster I've never been able to coax out of mine. She stared at me with interest now, her manner faintly amused.
Whose estate is it?
She had this way of asking certain questions with no tilt at the end, soliciting information by making flat statements that I was supposed to respond to.
Odd. It made me wary somehow, and I found myself taking care with what I said. A cousin, apparently someone in Ohio. Isn't it a bit radical to hire a private detective so you can hand out $3,000?
There are other inheritors involved, I said.
You have some kind of form you want her to sign.
I want to talk to her first. People are worried because they haven't heard from her. I'd like to include something in my report about where she's been.
Oh, my God, now we got a report. She was restless. She's been traveling. What's the big deal?
Do you mind if I ask you about your relationship with her?
No, I don't mind. We're friends. I've known her for years. She came down to Florida this time, and she wanted some company.
When was this?
Middle of January. Something like that.
She paused, watching the ash on her cigarette. Her eyes came up to mine again, her expression remote.
And you've been staying here ever since?
Sure, why not?
I just lost the lease on my place, and she said I could move in.
Why'd she take off?
You'd have to ask her that.
When did you last hear from her?
2 weeks ago, something like that.
And she was in Sarasota then?
That's right. Staying with some people she met.
Can you tell me who?
Look, she wanted me to keep her company, not babysit. It's none of my business who she hangs out with, so I don't ask.
I felt as if we were playing a parlor game that I couldn't possibly win. Pat Usher was having a better time than I was, too, and I resented that. I went at it again. Was it Mrs. Peacock in the library with the rope?
Can you tell me anything else you think might help?
I wasn't aware I'd helped so far, she said with a smirk. I was trying an optimistic approach, I snapped. She shrugged.
Sorry to dim your little ray of hope. I told you everything I know.
I guess we'll have to let it go at that. I'll leave you my card. If she calls again, would you have her contact me?
Hey, sure, no sweat.
I took a card out of my wallet and put it on the table as I got up.
I understand you're getting some hassles from people here. Can you believe that? I mean, what's it to them? I've paid my rent. No parties, no loud music. I hang my laundry out and the manager comes unglued. Through a fit. I don't get it. She got to her feet and led me to the door. The caftan billowing out behind her made her seem like a larger woman than she was. As I went past the kitchen, I caught sight of some cardboard boxes stacked up near the sink. She turned and followed my gaze. I'll probably find a motel close by if it comes to that. The last thing in the world I need is the sheriff on my case. That's who I thought you were, as a matter of fact. They got women sheriffs these days, did you know that? Sheriffettes. So I've heard. What about you? She asked. How'd you become a detective? That's a weird way to make a living, isn't it? She was becoming real chatty now that I was on my way out, and I wondered if I might pump her for more information. She seemed eager to prolong the contact, like someone who's been cooped up too long with a pack of preschool kids. I sort of backed into detective work, I said, but it beat selling shoes. You don't work yourself? Not me. I'm retired. I don't ever want to work again. You're lucky. I don't have much choice. If I don't work, I don't eat. She smiled for the first time. I used to spend my life waiting for a break. Then I figured out I better make my own luck. You know what I mean? Nobody gives you nothing in this world, that's for sure. I feigned agreement, glancing down toward the parking lot. I better be on my way, I said. But could I ask you one more thing? Like what? Do you know Elaine's other friends? There must be someone who knows how to get in touch with her, don't you think? I'm the wrong one to ask, she said. She used to visit me down in Lauderdale, so I don't know friends of hers up here. How'd you connect up this time? I understand she flew down almost on impulse. She seemed momentarily perplexed at that, but regained her composure. Yeah, that's right, she did. She called me from the airport in Miami and then picked me up on her way through. In a rented car? Yeah, an Oldsmobile Cutlass. White. How long was she here, then, before she took off? Pat shrugged again. I don't know. Not long. A couple of days, I guess. Did she seem at all nervous or upset? She became faintly irritated at that. Wait a minute. What are you getting at? Maybe I could come up with something if I knew what was on your mind. I'm not sure, I said mildly. I'm just fishing around, trying to figure out what's going on. The people who know her in Santa Teresa think it's unusual that she'd disappear without a word. But she told me. I've been telling you that. What is she, some kind of kid that she has to call home all the time and tell someone where she is and what time she's getting in? What's the problem? There isn't one. Her sister wants